We're going to fly into the theme of blessing and fly through it at a ridiculous speed. But you've got the references there, you can do it later on. We need to take a little sidebar here to explain a very bizarre concept to Westerners, which is blessing. And we have a bizarre story that makes no sense to us as Westerners. In Genesis 27, we think of the word blessing and the blessing of God being blessed as a cute, sweet thing to say to somebody. In the ancient world, it was the flip side of being supernaturally cursed. You imagine a witch or a necromancer or a sorcerer casting an evil spell on you, and it has a supernatural power to make it come true. And it's a creepy thing. It would something that you would never want to happen to you. In the ancient world, curses and blessings were both like that. They were both supernaturally overwhelming, and they understood that there's nothing light about saying God bless you. It's actually a supernatural act. And we see this most dramatically in the story of Jacob and Esau, where Jacob steals his brother's blessing. Remember, he dresses up, wraps his arms in the goat skin, so he's hairy, and he smells like his brother because he's stolen his coat. Must have been stinky. And he tricks his blind father into giving him the blessing. And in 27 verse 25, Isaac says, "Bring it near to me so that I may eat of my son's game and bless you." So he brought it near to him, and he ate and brought him wine, and he drank. Then his father Isaac said to him, "Come near and kiss me, my son." So he came near and kissed him, and Isaac smelled the smell of his garments and blessed him, and said, "See, the smell of my son is as the smell of a field that Yahweh has blessed. May God give you of the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and plenty of grain and wine. Let people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be lord over your brothers, and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be everyone who blesses you." Now that's a sweet thing to say. You know, may the Lord make the sun shine on your back. May you travel safely. May you have good health. I wish you well. Blah, blah, blah. No, these are actually predestinations. These come true. These are now in cement. They're irrevocable. They have to come true for Isaac. And so when his brother comes back, listen to the brother's reaction. 32. And his father said to him, "Who are you?" He answered him, "I'm your son, your firstborn, Esau." Then Isaac trembled very violently and said, "Who was it then that hunted game and brought it to me, and I ate it before you came, and I have blessed him? Yes, and he shall be blessed." As soon as Esau heard the words of his father, he cried out with an exceeding great and bitter cry, and said to his father, "Bless me, even me also, my father. But his father said, "Your brother came and deceitfully, and he has taken away your blessing." Esau said, "Is he not rightly named Jacob?" As in scumbag. "For he has cheated me these two times. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he has taken away my blessing. Have you not reserved a blessing for me?" Listen to Isaac. He says, Jacob answered and said to Esau, Isaac answered and said to Esau, "Behold, I have made him lord over you, and all his brothers I have given to him for servants." Who's his brothers? You, mate. "And with grain and wine I have sustained him. What then can I do for you, my son?" Esau said to his father, "Have you but one blessing, my father? Bless me, even me also, O my father." And Esau lifted up his voice and wept. And Isaac is saying, I can't do it. I cast the spell. It's an irrevocable spell. I made the spell. It can't be broken. This is going to happen.
And he says, well, can't you bless me with something? He says, no, I made you his servant. I made all of the fat of the land and the wine and the oil and the wealth around the place. It's all going to come to him because I uttered the blessing, which has the gravity of, in our understanding, I uttered the curse, the deplorable word. This is the benevolent word. And then when Jacob is dying, he calls his 12 sons and he blesses them and he tells what's going to happen to each of the 12 sons at the end of Genesis. And over the next 1,000 years, it all comes true. Everything that he prophesies about his sons comes true for each of the tribes. So the blessing of God and the idea of blessing is not a lightweight, charming, friendly, kind thing to say to somebody. It's a supernatural, predestining, magic word that has power to make itself come true irrevocably. So when we go now in the garden, Yahweh blessed Adam and Eve. It explicitly says he blessed them. And then he pronounced all these goodnesses upon them. And he gave them the garden, he gave them the blessing. And he included them in the blessedness of the Sabbath, which he blessed. Yahweh blessed the Sabbath. And so they were blessed themselves and they lived in the blessing of the Sabbath. Now, when the giver of a blessing is cursed by those who receive the blessing, that's a nuclear bomb. And Adam and Eve effectively told God, go to hell, when they signed up with Satan. And so the blessing is now, in Genesis 3, come curses. There's the curses on the serpent. Adam and Eve are not directly cursed, but there's a curse put on the ground. And in Romans 8 it says that all creation was subjected to futility at the fall. And it may be a way of saying all creation was subjected to entropy from that day. There's the curse on the relationship between there's the troubles on the relationship between childbearing and the relationship between the husband and the wife, and then the banning from the garden. And so there's what Adam and Eve can now do to restore the blessing is minus nothing, because they voided the blessing. But Yahweh has blessed them, and Yahweh's word can't be overturned. And he determines that he's going to bless his children whether they like it or not. And so he blesses Noah, and he then he comes to Abraham. And we see in the Genesis 12, let's go there. Genesis 12, 1 to 3 is the chapter headings of the whole Bible. Now Yahweh God said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house, abandon your life to the land I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, one, and I will bless you, two, I will make your name great, three, you will be a blessing, I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in your name all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So this is Yahweh issuing a dictatorial ultimatum of blessing. And Abram at this stage, has nothing to do with it and no rights in relation to it. God is dictating that he will be blessed over and over there, whether he likes it or not. I'm going to make you live under my blessing, under my wealth, under my care, and under my love, regardless of the fact that you've been a moon worshipper and that you live in a country, I'm going to take you to a country you've never seen. I'm going to make all these things come true for you because I have pronounced the blessing. And the rest of the Bible is him making these seven promises come true, and the seventh is the last one, which is where all the earth will be under the blessing of God, whether it likes it or not. And we see then in chapter in 10 to 17, Abram and Sarai go down into Egypt, Later on in chapter 20, they go down into Egypt again, or is that Isaac 20? Abraham and Abimelech. Abraham dealing with Abimelech. And then in 26, Isaac has the same story, ended up going down to Gerar or going down to Egypt. 26. And you'll see on the picture here, this is what happens. Now, in these stories, there's no moral virtue on the part of Abram. He doesn't do anything right. Isaac, they don't do anything right, anything wrong, anything interesting at all. They go down there because of famines. And in these cases, the people down there represent a threat because he's going into enemy territory. And so in one place, they take Sarai into the harem of Abimelech, is it there? And then Rebecca has the same thing. And the result, and in one of them, Abraham lies to the ruler and says, well, she's my sister. Now, he's not actually technically lying, and they've made an agreement before that whenever they travel, they will call each other brother and sister whenever they're with foreigners. Because, and this is still true in some places in the world, I heard there's a story about some African missionaries in Kenya or Uganda last century, where two female missionaries went into a tribal area and were the first white people ever there and were preaching the gospel to them. And they converted the king and then the whole tribe. And later on, the king explained was explaining what had happened and said, well, listen, if missionaries had come to us with the gospel and they were male, we would have just killed them the day they arrived. And if missionaries had come that were married, we would have just killed the man because we would take his wife and she would be part of our group. And if missionaries came who were women, we would have just taken them and married them and made them be part of our people. But you came, you two came, and on the first day you were here, you called me brother. And so I was bound to protect you, and we couldn't harm you, and we couldn't do anything for you, and we were obliged to feed you and to make sure that your housing and every need was met because you called me brother. And so I was doomed. And so we all became Christians. And so what Abraham is doing is, in that kind of culture, if I'm your husband, I'll be killed. Bang. I am actually your half-sister, half-brother, you're my half-sister, so we're going to call each other sister, because then what will happen is that the men will negotiate with me because they recognize my responsibility to protect you until you're married. And so they'll negotiate with me, and we won't be killed. So we read it as Westerners and say, Abraham sucks. He pretended he wasn't married. It's a bit more complicated than that. But so let's even say he was terrible. In all these stories, there's no virtue or anything good about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And here's what happens. This is a series of beings walking to the northeast, right? Because they're down in Egypt or down in Gerar, and they're coming back toward the Holy Land. There's Abraham's feet right up the middle, his footprints. He's walking home. There's the tracks of the cart. What's in the cart? Gifts. Gifts of gold and silver and every kind of wealth that these kings give to Abraham to get rid of him because the plague has come, or give to Isaac because the disease has come, or their wombs have been stopped, or so on. Here's on the left, there are sheep prints, and then on the donkey prints there, camel prints, sheep prints, goat prints, and then on the outsides there are male and female servants. So because of the troubles that Yahweh, Sarah goes into the harem of Abimelech, Rebecca goes into the harem, and disaster comes upon these guys. And it's revealed to... Listen to this. I haven't got time to do this. I just want to tell you about it. It's so cool. Read what happens in 13. We'll scooch down to Genesis 12. So in 12:17, Yahweh afflicted Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abraham's wife. What is this you've done to me? Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Pharaoh gave men orders, and they sent him away with wife and all that he had, The next one is in chapter 20. This is interesting. In chapter 20, verse 3, Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. But God came to Abimelech in a dream and by night and said, "Behold, you are a dead man because of the woman who you have taken, for she is a man's wife." Now Abimelech had not approached her. So he said, now this is a pagan king, right? This is how pagan kings talk, what happens in a conversation with a pagan king in Yahweh. "Lord, will you kill an innocent people?" These are not innocent people, come on. "Will you kill an innocent people? Didn't he not himself say to me, 'She is my sister,' and she herself said, 'He is my brother'? In the integrity of my heart and in the innocence of my hands, I have done this." He doesn't know his theology, does he? So, God, who also doesn't know his theology, says to him in the dream, "Yes, I know that you have done this in the integrity of your heart. And it was I who kept you from sinning against me." Does Yahweh know who he's dealing with here? "Now then, therefore I did not let you touch her. Now then, return the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and so that he will pray for you, and you shall live. But if you do not return her, know that you and yours shall surely die, you and all who are yours." So Abimelech rose, Abraham, "What have you done to us?" "I did it because I thought there was no fear of God at all in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. And she is in fact my sister." Abimelech took sheep and oxen and male servants and female servants and gave them to Abraham and returned Sarah his wife to him. "Behold, my land is before you, dwell wherever it pleases. Behold, to Sarah, I have given your brothers 1,000 pieces of silver. It is a sign of your innocence in the eyes of all who are with you and before everyone you have indicated." Then Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech and his wife and his female slaves. So this is one of the many stories. Abraham ends up with just tons of men working for him. He ends up with cattle and sheep that are too many for Lot and him to live together. And he ends up with all this wealth. His sons end up with the same thing. Jacob runs off to Haran and comes back with droves of cattle, giving away 400 here as a gift and a few hundred there as a gift. And so, again, if you read Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, there's pretty much no virtue in any of them. They're not very good people. But it's not a morality tale. The Bible's not a morality tale. The Bible is the tale of God blessing Abraham and his children, whether they like it or not, whether they do the right thing or not, he's going to do it because his hand is over them. When we go to the next slide, we go into the time of Moses and the Exodus. And you'll see all these. Let's look at the picture in your book, page 67. See the hands there? Balak and Balaam are those angry hands down the bottom. You see them? They're held out against the people of Israel that are camped there on the side of the Jordan. And the tribe, the Moabite king, Balak, has summoned from Mesopotamia the sorcerer, Balaam, supernatural evil prophet. And he's paid him, you know the story of Balaam's ass and so on. He's come, and Balak takes Balaam to a certain place. Balaam goes through his sorcery rituals and he goes to stand and cast the curse over Israel. And out of his mouth comes a blessing. And he's released from the blessing. He goes back to Balak. Balak starts screaming at him, "You idiot, I'm paying you a fortune to come down here and you're busy blessing. I've just paid you to curse them. You've done all your sorcery. And now you've actually pronounced it, and say, let's try again, we'll go over here." So they go three times to different places to overlook the Israelites, to hold out his hand and cast the curse. And every time he opens his mouth, Yahweh pronounces a blessing on his people. And the third time, Balak's psycho mad because, "You idiot, you've betrayed me, you've worse than betrayed me, you've done everything wrong." And Balak says, "Wait, there's something else." And he doesn't do his sorcery ritual. And he finds that another blessing comes out of his mouth. And now, who's Balak? King of the Moabites. You ready? Here's the fourth blessing coming out of Balaam's mouth. He says, here is the oracle of Balaam, the son of Beor, the oracle of the man whose eye is opened, the oracle of him who hears the words of God and knows the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty falling down with his eyes uncovered. I see him. I see him. He's seeing someone. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star, this is like one day, a star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter, a ruler, shall rise out of Israel. It shall crush the forehead of Moab and break down all the sons of Sheth. And so we see in this story, these see the four hands up the middle? There's the hands that are against Israel at below, those fierce hands, Balak and Balaam. But there are these four pronunciations, the last one of which actually pronounces the crushing of the skull of the person who's paid for the curses. And the reason is because, see the two great big hands there on page 67? Because Yahweh's hands of blessing are over Israel. And they can trump all that a sorcerer and all that a foreign king can bring in attempting to curse. What are the Israelites doing well here? And doing right and doing virtuously? Nothing at all. They've been wandering in the desert for punishment for 38 years. But that's irrelevant because Yahweh's hand is on them. And he will bless them and he'll bless them. His blessing overrules any curse that can come. So that's one of the many, many places in the Deuteronomy, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Leviticus stuff where there are blessing stories. Where the theme of blessing comes out. And overrules. Quickly we'll go through the time of the kings. The story of the Queen of Sheba. God has blessed the people with the geography of owning the land, economic wealth, political power, military security, the kingdom of God on earth. He's blessed them and blessed them and blessed them. The word blessing is used in these stories of what's happened under David and Solomon. And he brings as a witness the Queen of Sheba. And the Queen of Sheba's story, she comes and she declares as a foreign dignitary, as a foreign king, all of the blessings of Yahweh that have come upon Solomon and upon all of his people. And so she brings as her blessing, she showers Solomon with the gifts of her kingdom. And she declares, Yahweh has blessed you and fulfilled his promises of blessing to his people in all of this land and all of your rule. And then Solomon, because he is blessed by Yahweh, gives her twice as many gifts back because he's rich beyond the dreams of avarice. And so the blessing of Yahweh's people and Yahweh's king and Yahweh's place now just spills over onto even the foreigners. The Gentile queen now starts to inherit the blessings of God, which is a foretaste of what was promised in Genesis 12 verse 3. Through your seed, all of the nations on earth will be blessed. And so Queen of Sheba goes back home richer than when she came. Not only in the knowledge and the marvels that she'd seen, the Grand Canyon of looking at his kingdom, but she actually goes back home and says, guys, I made another few billion dollars. Go figure. And that wealth has gone back because of God's blessing. That's one of the blessing stories in the time of the kings. There's blessing psalms. The word blessed shows up in the psalms all the time. Here's two quickly. This one here, Psalm 2. Blessed is the man who doesn't walk in the way of sinners, etc. His delight is in the Lord. He meditates on the Lord day and night. He is blessed like living beside a river, like a tree beside a river that roots go down. And in all the seasons, he receives blessing. Blessed is the one who is forgiven by God, Psalm 32, whose sins are not counted against him. So this is the blessed is the righteous man who trusts his word and obeys him. This is blessed is the unrighteous man who comes to God for mercy because he receives blessing. He'll be in a high tower. The waves will not overpower him.
the story of Job, which is at the top of the screen and the bottom of the screen. Job had 7 boys and 3 girls and sheep and camels and oxen and donkeys and manservants and maidservants at the beginning of the story. They're all taken away. So he was blessed at the beginning, and he understands that it's all about blessing, and he says, "Blessed be the Lord who gives and the Lord who takes away." And at the end of the story, he ends up with sheep and camels. This is the order: sheep and camels, oxen, donkeys, 7 boys, 3 girls, and grandchildren. And again, it says Yahweh blessed him with all of these things. And you can see that the blessing is not associated with his faithfulness, his obedience, his prayer, anything like that, because he was given the blessing at the beginning of the story. He's given the blessing at the end of the story. There's a period where the Lord takes away, but not because of his sin, because of God's own purposes and his own wisdom and his own love for Job. And at the end of the story, he's blessed, not because he was the overcomer, but because Yahweh has pronounced his blessing. And that's how Yahweh is. He's a dictator. Wink, wink. He's the kind of dictator that you would like, "Can I go and live in that country?" Next story, in the time of the prophets, just so much in the prophets about blessing. This particular story in Isaiah is one of these passages. If you read it carefully, you know that it shouldn't be in the Bible. So we're going to read it carefully and see if you can pick it. When I'm saying things shouldn't be in the Bible and the verse must be wrong, I'm being facetious. What I'm saying is that the revelation of God is too big for our minds to be able to master. Assyria and Egypt. Okay, we're going to go to Isaiah 11. And to set this up, you have to realize that Egypt and Assyria, they're the two great empires before Babylon. They have a giant war at one point. Who's sandwiched right between them? Israel. And these are the constant military threats. These are the superpowers around little Israel. And they're the enemies. Egypt is the place of sin. It's the place of death. It's called in the prophets the place of graves. It's spiritual death. It's where Satan with his serpent headdress lives. Assyria is the most violent country on earth. They would rip their victims apart. They would tear their flesh. They were torturers. And they have there's friezes and so on about how they chop the bodies of their victims up, how they lead them away on hooks. So they impale people on hooks and drag them back to other countries. And they would, whenever they conquered a country, they would divide. If anyone they left alive, they would separate and send them to all the corners of the empire so that they could never form again as an ethnic group. They would be forced to blend in because there's only one or two of them at each place. They couldn't form a ghetto. And in this context, because of the blessings and because of the nature of God, watch the blessings here. This in verse 11. In that day, so there's these prophecies about the day coming, the day of the Lord. In that day, the Lord will extend his hand yet a second time to recover the remnant that remains of his people. Now, these are the people who were conquered, the northern tribes of Israel. They're conquered, most of them are killed, they're taken away on hooks, and then they're separated into all the nations so they can't form as a nation anymore. In that day, the Lord will extend his hand yet a second time to recover the remnant that remains of his people from Assyria, from Egypt, from Pathros, from Cush, from Elam, from Shinar, from Hamath, and from the coastlands of the sea. He will raise a banner, a signal for the nations, and he will assemble the banished of Israel. He will gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. The jealousy of Ephraim shall depart, and those who harass Judah shall be cut off. Ephraim shall not be jealous of Judah. This is the two, the north and the south, who've been at civil war 400 years. Ephraim shall not be jealous of Judah, and Judah shall not harass Ephraim, but they together shall swoop down on the shoulder of the Philistines to the west. Together they shall plunder the peoples of the east. They shall put out their hand against Edom and Moab, and the Ammonites shall obey them. So you see this destruction. All their enemies are being wiped out. Bang, bang, bang. And you can imagine the Israelites hearing this and reading this going, yeah, yeah, yeah. Like a sports game, football or something. And Yahweh will utterly destroy the tongue of the sea of Egypt. And he will wave his hand over the river, the Euphrates, with his scorching breath and strike it into seven channels. And he will lead people across in just sandals. Everybody, yeah, yeah. And there will be a highway from Assyria for the remnant that remains of his people. Yeah, as there was for Israel when they came up from out of the land of Egypt. Yeah. That's good, isn't it? And 19, an oracle concerning Egypt. Behold, Yahweh is riding on a swift cloud and comes to Egypt, and the idols of Egypt tremble at his presence. The hearts of the Egyptians will melt within them. More of this this conquest and smashing around and so on. And princes of Zoan are foolish. There'll be nothing left for Egypt. Egypt will stagger in all its deeds as a drunken man staggers in his vomit. 16. In that day the Egyptians will be like women and tremble with fear before the hand of Yahweh, the hand that Yahweh of hosts shakes over them. The land of Judah will become a terror to the Egyptians. Everyone to whom it is mentioned will fear because of the purpose that Yahweh of hosts has purposed against them. In that day, down in 19, there will be an altar to Yahweh in the midst of the land of Egypt, and the pillar to Yahweh at his border. Wait a minute. I hope this is a sacrificial altar where we're slaying the Egyptians, you know. This shouldn't be a religious altar, I hope. It will be a sign and a witness to Yahweh of hosts in the land of Egypt. When they cry to Yahweh because of oppressors, he will send a savior and defender and deliver them. And Yahweh himself will make himself known to the Egyptians. And the Egyptians will know Yahweh in that day and worship with sacrifice and offering. And they'll make vows to Yahweh and perform them. What? This is wrong. And Yahweh will strike Egypt. Yeah. Striking and healing. No. And they will return to Yahweh and he will listen to their pleas for mercy and heal them. No, no, no. In that day there will be a highway. Here's the highway again. From chapter 11. From Egypt to Assyria. And Assyria will come into Egypt and Egypt into Assyria. And the Egyptians will worship with the Assyrians. Who are they going to worship? They're going to worship the Assyrian gods? Or maybe the Assyrians are going to worship Ra? In that day, Israel will be the third with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the earth, whom Yahweh of hosts has blessed, saying, blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance. Did you hear the word blessed there all the time? God's a dictator with his blessing. He's just going to say, this is how it's going to be. I am going to dictatorially take over your mortal enemies, and I'm going to bless them, I'm going to unite them with my people Israel, and they'll be named with them. The Gentiles will come into my land and my kingdom and belong to me because I'm having all these places because I declare my blessing on them. And so there's the Egyptian and the Assyrian and the highway, but the hands of blessing of Yahweh trump all, even Israel's own self-interest. Next picture is the time of the remnant. We're moving through again. So God blesses an individual, Abraham. He blesses the people when they come out of Egypt. And then he blesses the whole kingdom. Then he blesses in the wisdom. Now he's blessing in the prophets. And now he's blessing in the remnant. I'll skim this one real quick. Haggai. The story is of Haggai is the this poverty in the land. It's been years since the people were building the temple. They stopped restoring things. They're taking care of their own paneled houses, their summer houses. They're wealthy enough to have a second house, but God keeps putting holes in their wallets so that they can't. The famines come, there's troubles come, and nothing seems to stick. And he says, "Listen, you dudes, if you will trust me, and come back and build my temple, which is what I appointed you to do 18 years ago or something, a long time ago. If you'll get back to it, count the day and see what happens." And they actually gather, they repent, they come back and they lay the foundation stone on the 18th of December, 520 BC.
And the prophet comes from Yahweh that time and he says, from this day, you've obeyed me. You've obeyed me. Let me read what he says. Can someone get to Haggai before me? If you've got it there.
It's in my Bible. That must be in the Apocrypha, right?
Haggai, here we go. It's page 1520. Yeah, that'll help, won't you? Okay, let me read it to you. Consider this day onward, from the 24th day of the ninth month. This is the modern calendar date on the screen there. This is not the Hebrew calendar date. Consider this day. This is the 24th day of the ninth month. Since the day that the foundation of Yahweh's temple was laid, consider this. Is the seed yet in the barn? No, they're in a famine. Indeed, the vine, the fig tree, the pomegranate, and the olive tree have yielded nothing. But from this day on, I will bless you. He's prophesied that I will fill your barns to overflowing with the... where was the prophecy on that one? We sing it. I can't find it. But there's the barley, the grapes, the olives, the pomegranates, the figs. And he says, from that day on, your storehouses will be blessed because I'm determined to do it. And I've withheld your blessing to bring you back to me. And now you've obeyed me. Here it comes. Turn the page. We are in John chapter 1. I'm going to skim this. Quick note on the Beatitudes. Jesus comes and he opens his preaching in Matthew by pronouncing Beatitudes, the blessings. And if you as a preacher teach people to apply the Beatitudes, you are cancelling each blessing. Did you hear me? These are blessings. Jesus is standing on the mountain and he is proclaiming blessings on the people. And we trying to take the text and we say, you know, blessed are the poor in spirit. You should be poor in spirit. Here's how to be poor in spirit. Blessed are the merciful. See, mercy is a good virtue and God is merciful and you should be merciful. Here's how we can be merciful in the church. As you take each beatitude and teach it, you cancel it. You cancel it as a blessing because what God is actually announcing, Jesus is announcing his blessing on all those people who are in those states. It's not a teaching of how we should be. It's a teaching of what is. This is how it is. Yahweh blesses these people already. This is his nature. Those who are poor and persecuted, their spirits are empty and they're useless. They hunger and thirst for righteousness because they're not getting any. God blesses them. I pronounce my eternal blessing on you. Jesus himself, it says that he was full of grace and truth. The law came through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. Grace, the gift and the word. And so you can see the picture there that Jesus is pouring out a gift and the word, those two images there. But they're also being poured into him by the Father. This is my Son, in whom I love, with him I am well pleased. I've given him all things. And it says that in John chapter 1, it says that from Jesus... from Moses came the law, from Jesus grace and truth. And from him we have received blessing upon blessing, i.e. blessing squared. He pours the blessing of God onto us indiscriminately, carelessly, abundantly, because he's magnanimous, because that's who he is. And God's always operated this way. If we turn to the next slide, you can see the blessing of the church. There are a whole lot of references there. On the top left, it says that there's a scripture that says, all of the promises of the prophets are delivered to us in Christ. That's in Acts 3, 18 to 25. Acts 3, 26 is that we are... I'm not going to go through them individually. We are rescued... We are delivered all of the promises that come to the seed in Galatians. All the promises that come to the seed come to us and they are credited to us because of Jesus. That's Galatians 3. You have not been saved by the letter of the law, but by the Spirit. The Spirit is the blessing of God. The kingdom of the blessing of God comes in Galatians 3:14 as the Spirit. And then in Ephesians... All of the blessings of the heavenly realms are now poured out upon us in Jesus.
all of the blessings by His the blessedness of God. He has chosen us. He has purchased us with an inheritance. This is the blessing of the Father, the blessings of the Son. We're bought with gold, with more precious than gold. We've been purchased with blood, and then we are sealed. And it's the blessing of the Father, then the blessing of the Son, and then the blessing of the Holy Spirit. We're sealed eternally to be brought home. So all of the blessings through the entire Old Testament, through all of the prophets, are because of Jesus poured out upon the church. And if you concordance, the word blessing, the New Testament is full of the blessedness of God, this powerful word that cannot be revoked, that's coming from God. And then finally, on page 74, the new creation. Now we need to scoot back here. Please go to Exodus 26. Exodus 26. We've got some more science fiction here. Exodus 26, 31. This is in the making of the temple. There's the inner room, the holy place, and then the most holy place. Who can come into the most holy place? Only one man, only once a year, the Day of Atonement. No one else can go in there. What is in there? The Ark of the Covenant, the wings of the cherubim over the gold mercy seat. What is in the Ark? Tell me what's in the Ark. This is really good. Jar of manna, Aaron's staff, and the tablets. Now watch this. The jar of manna. What happens to manna after one day? So what kind of manna is this?
Eternal.
This is eternal manna. This is a manna that has inner life that never dies. What's happened to Aaron's staff? So this is a symbol of life out of what is death. Symbol of immortality, symbol of immortality. What's the third thing? The Torah. Whatever dies in the Torah? Nothing. Three symbols of immortal life are inside the box. Okay? Three symbols of immortal life are inside the box. What's on the top of the box?
Mercy seats.
Mercy seat. Specifically, a slab of gold with
cherubim
with their wings overshadowed over the mercy seat. And verse 31, 26, verse 31. You shall make a veil of blue and purple and scarlet yarns and finely twisted linen. It shall be made with cherubim skillfully worked into it. And you shall hang it on four pillars of acacia overlaid with gold, with hooks of gold on four bases of silver. And you shall hang the veil from the clasp and bring the ark of the testimony in there within the veil. And the veil shall separate you from the holy place, from the most holy. You shall put the mercy seat on the ark of the testimony in the most holy place. Now, where have we seen cherubim in the Bible? What are they?
Guardian
angels. When have we seen them before? Garden of Eden. What are they doing in the Garden of Eden? They're stopping humans from getting to
tree of life.
Okay, what are they doing here? They're stopping humans. What's in the box? Three symbols of immortality. The wings of the cherubim are guarding the three symbols of immortal life. And on the curtain here, on the veil, what's sewn into the veil?
Cherubim.
Cherubim stop us from getting where? Back to the tree of life. Garden of Eden. The temple is a model of the door to Eden. Do you remember the movie series Stargate? Or Doctor Who? Or Narnia the Wardrobe? In Narnia the Wardrobe is a portal into the other world. In the Stargate, you go through the ring into another space-time dimension. In the TARDIS, in Doctor Who, you go into the phone box, and inside the phone box is bigger than outside of the phone box. The space inside is infinitely bigger than the space out than the box. And these are gates into the other world, and that's what happens. They're in the middle of the desert, and God says, build this box, make it up like this, put the cherubim there, put the immortal life symbols in the ark,
I'm going to put cherubim over it. There's cherubim in the way. In there, you can't come, because in there, what do you get at? You can't come in. What's it going to cost you to come in? High priest, atoned for by blood, coming in to bring blood to atone for all of the people once a year. When Jesus is hanging on the cross, the thief says to him what? The second thief, remember me. And Jesus says, today I will remember you in paradise. Paradise is only occurs three times in the Bible. It's a loan word from the Sumerian languages. The Garden of Eden is the first one. That's paradise. Jesus says now, today you will see me in Eden. At the tree. And then, can you turn please to Matthew 27. Matthew 27. Please look it up, Matthew 27. Can someone read verse 51 to 53?
That moment the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook and the rocks split. The tombs broke open and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs, and after Jesus' resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many people.
What are you hearing, folks? The cherubim are torn away, and what's the very first thing that's recorded?
Resurrection
of dead people out of tombs, because eternal life has now been released into the world. Humanity now has access, and so Matthew gets it. He says, you know what happened? The temple was torn, the curtain in the temple with the cherubim on it that stopped us getting to the ark, stopped us getting to the tree of life in the Garden of Eden, was torn open, and we got back to the Garden of Eden so fast that dead men came out of boxes. And that's what's happened in at the cross of Christ. And so it's picked up in Revelation, and in 2:7 it talks about that we will be given, those who overcome will get the tree of life. And then in 22, let me pull these up. Revelation 2 verse 7. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one who conquers, I will grant to eat of the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God, which is in Eden. And what we've been waiting for so stinking long is now ours. In 22, verse 1 to 3, it says, the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb through the middle of the street of the city. Also on either side the river, the tree of life, with its 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit each month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. And in verse 4, no longer will there be anything cursed. The curse is forever gone. But the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it. His servants will worship in. Verse 14, blessed are those who wash their robes so that they may have the right to what? To the tree of life, and that they may enter the gates of the city. We're going to get home. We're going to get back home. We're going to be taken home. And the curtain is already finished. Okay, please turn to 75, page 75.